KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump lays out the biggest menu of tariffs yet. We speak with Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin on what he sees as the benefits of raising trade barriers. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Israeli troops are taking over more land in Gaza. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu says he's cutting up the Gaza Strip to pressure Hamas to return hostages. Aid groups say food is running out. Also, a new children's book by the author of Heavy, Kiese Lehman, celebrates the joy of feeling safe while exploring the world and the history of U.S. efforts to project soft power. It is Wednesday, April 3rd. On this day in 1948, President Truman signed the Marshall Plan to help European economies recover after World War II. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump's sweeping tariffs are hitting the share price of many U.S. retailers and tech companies in pre-market trading. Dow futures are down 3%. The minimum tariffs are 10%. NPR's Alina Selyukh reports heavy new tariffs on China appear to have taken investors by surprise.
Companies including Walmart, Target, Amazon, and Nike are poised to lead a drop in U.S. stock markets today. These companies depend quite a bit on imports from China, for which the new 34% tariff will stack on top of the existing 20% tariffs Trump had imposed for a total of 54% in tax. U.S. importers are on the hook to pay these new fees to receive the imports in the U.S. Many retailers have been diversifying their supply chains beyond China, but the new tariffs affect virtually every country in the world, with new levies on Vietnam, India, Cambodia, among others. Some retail giants, such as Walmart, are pressing their suppliers to shoulder some of the new costs. But generally, retailers warn they may have to raise consumer prices as a result. Alina Selyukh, NPR News.
Powerful storms are thundering across the central U.S. and parts of the Midwest. The National Weather Service is warning this is a significant weather event that is catastrophic and life-threatening. Meteorologist Mark Chouinard says there have been a lot of reported tornadoes.
Preliminarily, there's been several reports of tornadoes across portions, like I said, Missouri, western Tennessee, Kentucky. Some of the damage does look to be significant.
Authorities say the storms have left three people dead in Missouri and Tennessee. Another tornado warning has been posted for central West Virginia. Flash flood warnings are up this morning in much of Tennessee. The National Weather Service says exceptionally heavy rain is falling in several states, and by the weekend, up to 5 or 10 more inches of rain are predicted. A senior Russian economic envoy is in Washington for talks with White House officials. The meetings come as President Trump has expressed growing frustration with the Kremlin over the pace of U.S.-backed negotiations to end the war in Ukraine. From Moscow, NPR's Charles Maines has more.
Kirill Dmitriev is the head of Russia's sovereign wealth fund. He's also emerged as President Vladimir Putin's choice for special envoy for economic cooperation amid recent U.S.-Russian negotiations. Harvard-educated and formerly under U.S. sanctions, Dmitriev is expected to meet with White House envoy Steve Witkoff. The Russian envoy has been an advocate for the return of dialogue between Moscow and Washington under the Trump administration and suggested the two sides could cooperate on everything from mineral extraction to Arctic development and space exploration. Dmitriev's visit to Washington comes as Trump has said he's mulling massive tariffs on Russian oil exports if the U.S. ultimately decides Russia is dragging its feet on negotiations over Ukraine. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
On Wall Street, Dow futures are down 3%, NASDAQ futures are down 4%. It's NPR. The outplacement job firm Challenger Grain Christmas released its report on job cuts in March. It found more than 275,000 job losses last month. That was driven by DOGE layoffs in the federal government. A lawsuit filed by the ACLU says the National Institutes of Health must restore more than $1 billion in grants. The organization is demanding the Trump administration stop its, quote, ideological purge of federally funded research. From member station WBUR, Martha Biebinger has more.
The ACLU claims the NIH's canceling of research because it mentions gender identity, diversity, vaccine hesitancy, and COVID is unconstitutional and unlawful. Harvard Associate Professor Brittany Charlton has lost $5.9 million in contracts because they did not fit Trump administration priorities.
It actually doesn't matter, from my understanding, what the future priorities are, because our current contracts are contracts, and the way in which they are terminating them is very outside the norm.
There's no response yet from the Trump administration. The suit includes other individual scientists, a union representing university employees, and the American Public Health Association. For NPR News, I'm Martha Biebinger in Boston.
NPR has learned that tech giant Amazon is bidding to acquire video sharing app TikTok. Saturday is the deadline for the app to be sold away from its Chinese parent. But NPR has learned that a different coalition of U.S. firms may win the bid to buy TikTok. That coalition could include Oracle. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Penguin Lessons, a new comedy starring Steve Coogan as a teacher whose life is upended after he rescues a penguin from an oil-slicked beach. Now playing in theaters.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In a few minutes, we're going to speak with Republican Senator Ron Johnson about how the Trump administration's tariffs could affect his home state of Wisconsin, which is one of the U.S.'s manufacturing powerhouses.
But first, we're going to explain those tariff plans. They're designed to limit imports and encourage domestic manufacturing.
Starting this weekend, Trump plans to charge a minimum 10% tax on virtually all foreign goods coming into the U.S., with imports from dozens of countries facing much higher levies. Speaking in the White House Rose Garden yesterday, Trump said the tariffs would help spark a rebirth of American industry.
We're going to produce the cars and ships, chips, airplanes, minerals, and medicines that we need right here in America. The pharmaceutical companies are going to become roaring back. They're coming roaring back. They're all coming back to our country, because if they don't, they got a big tax to pay.
Early reaction to the president's move has been mostly negative. Stock futures fell sharply overnight. The European Union has threatened countermeasures, and other U.S. trading partners are expected to retaliate with tariffs of their own on U.S. exports.
NPR's chief economics correspondent, Scott Horsley, joins us now to break this down. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Lila.
All right. So, you know, President Trump promised high tariffs throughout the campaign. So is anyone actually surprised by this move?
I think they're surprised by the magnitude. Okay. For example, we're talking about a 20% tax on goods coming in from the European Union, much higher than the U.S. charges today. In other ways, though, this is not surprising. And despite the United States' wealth and power, Trump has been complaining for decades that this country is being taken advantage of, and he's determined to fight back with tariffs, even as financial markets have been flashing red, saying, don't do it. Now, Canada and Mexico, two of our biggest trading partners, are being spared these additional tariffs for now. But Trump is slapping stiff new taxes on imports from economies around the world, even for products we cannot produce in the U.S., like the coffee and banana you might be having for breakfast this morning.
Oh, wow. So how did the White House decide who pays what?
Trump calls these reciprocal tariffs, saying they're simply designed to match the trade barriers that other countries impose on U.S. exports.
That means they do it to us and we do it to them. Very simple. Can't get any simpler than that.
But the White House later acknowledged it would be too hard to calculate the actual trade barriers from every other country. So they just picked an arbitrary number they thought would be high enough to chip away at each country's trade surplus with the U.S.
Okay.
And the result is a huge tariff increase, a 24% tax on imports from Japan, a 34% tax on imports from China, in addition to the 20% tariffs that were already in place. Now, other countries might absorb some of that cost, but a big part will be paid by businesses and consumers here in the U.S.
So let's talk about that. What's the potential economic effect of that?
Economists say it will likely mean higher prices and slower growth. Consumers are nervous, so are exporters. Tim Fiore conducts a monthly survey of factory managers for the Institute for Supply Management. He says they're already bracing for retaliation.
Here it comes, and we're already seeing that. We have manufacturers in the U.S. already feeling that experience. So the retaliatory tariffs are going to be really ugly. I mean, it's just going to kill demand.
Domestic manufacturers are supposed to be the beneficiaries of this trade war, but factory orders, output, employment were all down last month in anticipation.
And what about international fallout?
This is an enormous gamble. The U.S. launched a similar worldwide trade war back in the 1930s. It did not end well. The notorious Smoot-Hawley tariffs are widely considered to have worsened the Great Depression. And economists say Trump's new import taxes are even more draconian than those almost a century ago.
NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
So let's get some perspective now from someone who serves on the Senate Budget and Finance Committees. I want to mention he's also on the Subcommittee on International Trade, Customs, and Global Competitiveness. That's Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
So you've called tariffs a double-edged sword. Are you confident the sword is going to cut in the direction of the benefits and not the risks?
I have my concerns. I think the previous report was largely accurate. I would add that we obviously have a problem in this country. We have offshored many vital manufacturing of whether it's pharmaceuticals, whether it's the high-end semiconductors. There are all kinds of different things that we do need to manufacture here in the United States just for national security. So trade is an incredibly complex issue. Hard to say exactly how this all ends. You know, this is something President Trump has believed for decades. He is absolutely dedicated to it. I think it's a reasonably high risk. It's a very bold move. He'll either reap the rewards or suffer the consequences.
Hmm. As we heard in Scott Horsley's reporting, a survey from the Institute for Supply Management this week showed tariffs dragging on manufacturing. That's the very sector that import taxes are supposed to help. Now, 19% of Wisconsin's workers are employed in manufacturing. That's nearly double the national average. So what are you concerned about? What could be the impact on your state?
Well, it certainly could make those manufacturers less competitive when they export. At the same time, I'm hearing from manufacturers that are not happy with the trade barriers imposed on them as they try and export already. So, as I said, international trade is an incredibly complex issue. Now, I'm at my core a free but fair trader, and that's been the problem. We have not been engaged in fair trade. We haven't been treated fairly by many of our trading partners, and this is trying to level the playing field in a very complex environment.
I think you met with the president yesterday. Is that correct?
We did. He was obviously talking about this before the announcement, but we were primarily talking about what we can do to return to a pre-pandemic level of spending, which is another huge problem we have, going from $4.4 trillion to $7.3 trillion in just the last 6 years.
So, but can I just ask, understand the question of trade policy? Congress is supposed to play a role in that. Do you feel that the president is listening to you? Do you feel like you've had any input into this program before he rolled it out?
Well, Congress is willingly granted a lot of its constitutional authority to the president, and part of it on trade. And he's using that authority.
So, President Trump ran on immigration and inflation. Those were kind of the primary drivers of his campaign. If this does raise cost, how do you explain that to people who voted for him? Because they thought he would lower their cost of living.
Well, I think he's very aware of that. He also ran saying that tariff is the most beautiful word in the English language. So, this should not be unexpected. This is a core belief of his. And we're going to find out to what extent he's right and many people are wrong. I really don't know. Right now I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. There's not much I can really do about it. But keep the administration aware of what reactions are and you know, the impact it has on Wisconsin businesses and farmers.
And so, speaking of that, are you hearing from your constituents? How are they? What are they saying to you, and what are you saying to them?
Well, again, it's interesting. They're supportive of what President Trump's trying to accomplish, but yet they're concerned about the impact on their particular business. So everybody realizes this is a double-edged sword. That's very true. Some people know they're going to be impacted more than others. Some people are going to benefit from it. So it's a real mixed bag.
And so far, though, how are you explaining this to your constituents? Are you saying that you think the juice is going to be worth the squeeze in the long run? Or are you saying this is a moment of shared sacrifice? Or how are you talking about it with your constituents?
I'm telling them to keep me totally informed, and I'll keep the administration informed as well.
So before we let you go, what's the next step here? What are you going to be looking to? Or are there any particular data points before you feel like you need to speak up and say more? Or are you going to sort of go back to the president and try to get him to renegotiate? Is there some particular data point you're looking at?
Well, we'll take a look at exactly what investment is being pledged. Right now it's $5 to $6 trillion. We'll see how other nations react. And some are already decreasing, if not eliminating, their tariffs. So to a certain extent, that right now there's some positive impacts of this. Although, obviously, what's happened to the stock market's not positive.
That is U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. He's a Republican from Wisconsin. Senator Johnson, thanks so much for your time. I do hope we'll talk again.
Have a great day.
Country music superstar Morgan Wallen is releasing a new album next month. To call it highly anticipated doesn't do it justice. Stephen Thompson of NPR Music reports.
Every now and then I go get a taste, but I never fall in love, baby, just in case, just in case.
Morgan Wallen's latest single, Just In Case, debuts at number 4 on Billboard's main pop chart this week. That means he's done something no one has ever done before. But first, a quick explainer. There are many effective ways to roll out a new album. The traditional approach is to make an announcement months in advance, then allow new information and advanced singles to trickle out in the run-up to the release date. One new-school streaming-era approach has major stars dropping albums with little to no advance notice. There are risks and rewards to both approaches, but most labels still like to work with a little bit of a runway. Well, Morgan Wallen's forthcoming album, I'm the Problem, drops May 16th, but the pre-release runway stretches all the way back to last summer.
There ain't nothing but lies, 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 look into my eyes, eyes.
This was the first teaser. The single Lies, Lies, Lies came out in July. It peaked at number 7. Then came another single last November. That debuted at number 1. Wallen dropped 2 singles in January. Both hit the top 10. And now with the debut of Just In Case, Wallen has charted 5 top 10 singles from an album that isn't even out yet. And he's the first artist ever to do so. Prior to Wallen's feat, 2 artists have landed 4 top 10 singles in the run-up to an album's release, Post Malone and Taylor Swift. But Wallen stands alone, and he might not even be done yet. The album doesn't come out for another 6 weeks, and yet another of its songs, I'm a Little Crazy, debuts at number 17 on this week's chart. There's little question that I'm the Problem will be one of 2025's biggest albums. What remains to be seen is which Wallen song, if any, is able to break out as a dominant Song of the Summer-style chart topper. He's already bought 6 tickets for this year's sweepstakes. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
Yeah, the only thing keeping these tracks on the train. Knowing I'm a little crazy, but the world's insane.
This is NPR News.
Bury me where the wind don't
On the next Fresh Air, songwriter, singer, and guitarist Jason Isbell, who is described in Variety as the Poet Laureate of American Rock. He won 9 Americana Music Awards and 6 Grammys. His new solo album includes songs about the breakup of his marriage to singer-songwriter and violinist Amanda Shires. Join us.
See the windmills turn up 55.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Linda Moodbell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead. Online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodbell.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at Schwab.com. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldad.
And I'm Michelle Martin. When school's out and parents need a break or cheap long-term babysitting, for generations, kids, especially city kids, have gone to spend time with relatives in the summer. What are those days like away from home? What happens, though, when they're young black boys who are allowed to roam and explore away from rules and routines, but also away from everything they know? Writer and MacArthur genius Kiese Lehman has some ideas. He has written a stunning new children's book called City Summer, Country Summer, and he's with us now in our studios in Washington to talk about his version of Endless Summer Days in the South. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Michelle. I'm happy to be here with you.
Why a children's book? I think people who know your work know that one of your most well-known books, Heavy, it's titled Heavy, can be a little heavy.
Right. So, you know, we talked about Heavy when it came out, and one of the things that you said when we talked about that book was, it's just hard in this book. And I wanted to create something that was softer and honest. You know, I think that book was about, like, the origins and the consequences of a lack of safety for children. And so I wanted to really, like, sit in what happens if we really explore a culture and a society and grandmothers that help create safeness in spite of the unsafety of the world.
So tell us about the characters and the storyline in City Summer, Country Summer.
Yeah, so there's this kid in New York who comes down from New York to visit his grandmother, and then there's other two kids who come from Jackson, Mississippi. And so for the kid from New York, it doesn't matter that those kids are from Jackson, which is a city, they're country to him. And it doesn't matter for the country kids whether New York is actually from New York or from Rochester or from Albany.
Or New Rochelle.
Or New Rochelle, right? Yeah, he's New York to them. And so I just wanted to also create a book that was about, like, the imperative of, like, black boy softness. I think people a lot of times talk about black boy joy, but I don't think we talk a lot about the importance of black boy touch, black boy play, and black boy experimentation. And I got lucky in that the artist Alexis Franklin came on to create, like, I think one of the most lush picture books I've ever seen. And we really wanted to get forest and gardens into this space, because in my childhood, those were spaces that were ironically, like, the most safe for us. Those forests and those gardens were where we learned how to touch, where we learned how to accept touch. And even though we didn't use these words, they're also where we learned how to accept love. And that's really what I just wanted to create.
Well, why don't you read us some?
Absolutely.
This is the point in the book where they've been together for a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're in the woods for the first time, and I'll just start. New York wandered away from us and walked closer to the edge of the woods. You good? We asked. I'm ready to go home, he said. Something in those central Mississippi woods reminded New York of the language of home. Being reminded of home so far away from his newborn sister, Cece, so far away from the bodegas, the fire hydrants, and the city blocks, terrified or satisfied New York. Whether it was absolute fear or exquisite satisfaction, wandering through those cool spots in those Mississippi woods was too much for New York's body. We didn't speak this. New York didn't speak this. But our bodies knew.
That is lovely, and it's poignant, and it does so many things. Because one of the things that it made me think of is how, not just black boys, but maybe particularly black boys, we sometimes don't give them enough credit for having a depth of feeling.
That's true.
I mean, so much of the literature, it seems to me, around black boyhood is about being hard or being cool, but just the ordinary feeling of missing your baby sister.
Yeah.
And being homesick.
and being lost. And, you know, and I want to create art and read art where Black children are allowed to be lost, because being lost is a kind of experimentation. I just wanted to explore that sensibility of being somewhere new and missing somewhere old and longing for touch.
There's another passage I wanted you to read where you talk about that healing power. Would you read that for us, please?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So at this point, they've been looking for New York in the garden. They've been playing Marco Polo, and they can't find him.
Well, hold on, dude. People just, I don't know, does everybody know what Marco Polo is? It's like a game a lot of times you play in the,
right.
in the pool.
So when I came up north, I found out that people play Marco Polo in the pool because we played Marco Polo in the garden because we didn't have pools, right? And
okay.
So at this point, New York has found the boys, and the boys have found New York. In the middle of the garden, we felt a forceful wind getting closer to us. And when we turned around, New York tackled us and tumbled upon a row of my grandmama's butter beans. On the ground of that garden, covered in vegetables and dirt, coated in so much laughter, I want to say that the Mississippi and New York and our Black boy bodies were indistinguishable from each other. That would be a lie. We absolutely contrasted. But the sights, tastes, and smells of our contrast felt like safeness, not safety. Safeness. And safeness sounded like love.
Do you want to say more about that? What is the difference between safeness and safety?
Yeah, for me, I think, you know, growing up in Mississippi, you know, my grandmother worked in a chicken plant factory. She grew up in 1929. She knew segregation in ways I would never knew. She knew unsafety. And I grew up in the 80s and 90s, which were sort of unsafe times for a lot of Black children. But even in those unsafe spaces and times, I think there was like a bodily, psychological, emotional feeling of safeness when I was in my grandmother's house and my grandmother's like touch when she could see me. And so I'm trying to encourage us to, one, realize that every child on this earth deserves safety. But also, I think as parental figures, there's like a psychological, physical, spiritual safeness that we have to ensure that I think our children have. And it's hard to do that when we don't have it ourselves.
And creating a sense that this is important, acknowledging
Absolutely.
That it's important. I'm feeling like this book isn't just about sort of calling out something that's wrong. This book is about celebrating what could be right.
I wish I had that sentence when we were putting the book out. But it is absolutely about celebrating something that could be right. And that's something that can be right. We have to remind ourselves it can be our bodies. I think a lot of us move through the space in the world. I did as a young Black boy, thinking that my body was necessarily unsafe because of the way adults treated me, the way police treated me. But I was never treated unsafe by my grandmother.
And I wonder if maybe in a way this book is meant to be healing for adults too.
Absolutely. You know, before kids can read letters, they can read faces. And so my hope is that, like, you know, people who read to not, you know, 5-year-olds or 4th graders can share those facial expressions with young people who, you know, are in need of safety, but who are also in need of seeing that their fathers and their mothers and their uncles and their aunties' faces contort with the kind of joy that I think only children's books can bring.
Cassie Lehman is the author of the new children's book, City Summer, Country Summer. Cassie Lehman, thank you so much for talking to us.
I'm so thankful to be here. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
On President Trump's second day in office, Mari Stonick was told the government is shuttering all DEI offices and you're being put on leave.
I was incredibly shocked, and the first thing I said was, I'm not in a diversity, equity, and inclusion role.
Now Stonick and others are fighting back. I'm Ari Shapiro. That story on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Countries in the European Union are among those pledging to retaliate in response to President Trump's sweeping new tariffs. NPR's Rob Schmitz is in Berlin.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, whose office is negotiating with the Trump administration on behalf of all 27 European member states, says Trump's tariffs are a severe blow to the global economy and that the EU is preparing countermeasures to protect its interests. Outgoing German Chancellor Olaf Scholz says even if Europe does not respond, the U.S. will suffer economic difficulties. And German auto industry economist Ferdinand Dudenhofer says the U.S. is probably a greater economic enemy for Europe now than Russian President Vladimir Putin is. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
At the White House yesterday, Trump announced he was putting 10% tariffs on nearly all U.S. imports of foreign-made goods. The exceptions include imports of pharmaceuticals, semiconductors, and lumber. Trump also announced reciprocal tariffs on dozens of countries and territories. China accuses Trump of violating rules of the World Trade Organization and says it too will retaliate. Trump says the levies will bolster the economy and incentivize more companies to do business in the U.S., especially manufacturers. Economists say Americans will pay higher prices because of the tariffs. This is NPR News. This afternoon, a federal judge is scheduled to hold a hearing on whether the Trump administration defied his orders to halt deportation flights to El Salvador. Here's NPR's Joel Rose.
Federal Judge James Boasberg is asking the Trump administration to explain whether it violated his orders when it allowed two deportation flights to continue. Boasberg has temporarily blocked the administration from deporting alleged Venezuelan gang members under a rarely used wartime law known as the Alien Enemies Act. The judge is pushing for operational details about those flights, including what time they took off and when they left U.S. airspace. But the Justice Department has resisted, arguing in a court filing that answering the judge's questions would risk revealing important state secrets. Boasberg has vowed he will get to the bottom of whether the administration violated his orders and what the consequences should be. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
New York Mayor Eric Adams says he will run for re-election as an independent. In a video released this morning, Adams says he's dropping out of the city's Democratic mayoral primary. A federal bribery case against Adams was dismissed yesterday. The mayor says the publicity surrounding that case makes it impossible for him to run a successful primary campaign. Stocks on Wall Street opened sharply lower this morning as investors reacted to the president's new tariffs. The Dow is down nearly 1,200 points. The Nasdaq is off 4%. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced new details for his country's expanded incursion into Gaza. He says Israeli troops are taking over more land in the Palestinian territory. According to Gaza health officials, the Israeli military has killed more than 1,000 Palestinians since Israel ended a ceasefire with Hamas last month. To break down the details of this expanded incursion, we're joined by NPR's Hadil El-Shah in Tel Aviv. Good morning, Hadil.
Good morning.
So what is Israel saying it's going to do?
Well, all this week, Israel's defense minister has made it clear that Israeli troops are planning on seizing more and more land in Gaza and then adding it to a buffer zone with Israel. Then in a video statement last night, Netanyahu announced this third security corridor in Gaza. So in the past month, troops occupied a zone that cuts across Gaza's north. Troops already occupy a strip of land on Gaza's southern border with Egypt. So if this happens, it'll be an additional strip of land between those two, cutting across Gaza. Here's Netanyahu on his new plan.
He said, we are cutting up the strip. We are increasing the pressure step by step so that Hamas returns the hostages.
Also, Israel, we know, has been talking about permanently displacing Palestinians from Gaza.
And what does Israel want Hamas to agree to?
Well, Israel proposed last weekend for Hamas to release 11 hostages, including an American-Israeli dual national. That's about half of the living hostages still held in Gaza. It also wants Hamas to disarm. If Hamas agrees to this, Israel says there will be a 40-day ceasefire and then discussions to permanently end the war. But then yesterday, senior Hamas official Bassem Naim told NPR that Hamas is rejecting this proposal, calling it, quote, unacceptable. Hamas says it wants to go straight into talks about an end to the war. Israel says this is a strategy to twist Hamas's arm to agree to a deal that'll see more hostages come back home. But Israel's pressure campaign is working on a few different levels, you know, not just bisecting Gaza, but also ordering Palestinians to leave their shelters and blocking all aid. It's been blocked for a month now.
So a month without aid. What has that meant for Palestinians in Gaza?
Well, first, there's been this massive evacuation order this week to empty out 97% of the greater Rafah area in the south. The UN says now 100,000 Palestinians there are displaced. Umm Muhammad Abdullah is one of them. You know, she said, we have to count our daughters when we move. Are there three, four, or five? Is one of them missing? Did we lose a girl on the way? And then just today, another evacuation order was announced around Gaza City in the north. And then there's the aid. This has been the longest time Israel has blocked all aid into Gaza since the beginning of the war. That means no food, no medical supplies, no fuel that's needed to power things like health facilities. So Israel says there was a surge of aid during the first phase of the ceasefire. So Gaza still has enough food. But then aid groups are saying food is quickly running out. The World Food Program shut down all of its 25 bakeries in Gaza because they say they've run out of flour and fuel. It told us it only has 2 weeks' worth of food supplies. It's distributing them to charity kitchens, and most Palestinians depend on those kitchens for their one meal a day.
NPR's Hadil El Shalchi. Thank you, Hadil.
You're welcome.
There are different ways countries can project power around the world. One is with military strength. Another way has been targeted by the Trump administration's budget cuts. NPR's Emily Fang reports on what some of these projects and programs have delivered over the decades.
After World War II, the U.S. started building what scholars now call soft power tools. Of particular interest was radio.
From the Fairland headquarters, December the 28th,
a medium so powerful in winning hearts and minds that just a few years earlier, the Nazis subsidized the production of cheap radio sets. And after the defeat of the Nazis, the Allies, led by the United States, broke up Germany's national radio system into regional broadcasters to limit the power of the microphone. But the U.S. simultaneously invested in building that power for itself.
She methoded it in fascist.
In the 1950s, U.S. Congress authorized Radio Free Europe in Germany and later Radio Liberty to start beaming shortwave news reports into Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, including this broadcast in Romanian.
It was absolutely vital source of information to know what was going on in their own country.
This is Ronald Linden. He was a former research director at Radio Free Europe in 1989. From there, he witnessed the fall of the Berlin Wall that year, and then...
bang, down goes Czechoslovakia. And then they said, well, it'll never happen in East Germany. Bang. One after another, the regimes fell.
In the decades since the collapse of the Soviet Union, Radio Free Europe chronicled the rise of the European Union and democratic backsliding in Eastern Europe. But in March, President Trump ordered the agency, which oversees the outlet and other state outlets, dismantled, though Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, is challenging its funding freeze in court. Carrie Lake, Trump's appointee to head that agency, has said Radio Free Europe is being infiltrated by, quote, spies and terrorist sympathizers putting out biased coverage. Lake has defended the administration's dismantling of what she calls a rotten agency in the press, including in a March interview with Newsmax.
The rot is so bad, it's like having a rotten fish and trying to find a little portion you can eat. It's unsalvageable right now. And so I agree with President Trump. Let's scale this thing down to the bare bones minimum.
Though it's not clear whether the broadcasters will be dismantled entirely or retooled. Her agency did not respond to a request for comment. The federal cost-cutting has also hit a bevy of research centers and scholarships like the Fulbright and think tanks like the Wilson Center and the U.S. Institute of Peace, which bolster the U.S.'s foreign policy expertise. They are part of what makes the U.S. an intellectual powerhouse the world over. Here's Nicole Hemmer, a historian at Vanderbilt University, speaking about the Wilson Center's archives, which are now at risk.
The Cold War was kind of the foundational geopolitical reality for the United States for 40 years. And so these archives don't just help us understand the world, but they help us better understand our own history here in the United States.
And in turn, the U.S. built a deep pool of foreign leaders and academics who studied in the U.S. or grew up listening to American broadcasts.
That's the problem with the idea of soft power. It's very hard to quantify, but it was very real.
This is Derek Mitchell. When he was the U.S. ambassador to Myanmar, he frequently encountered foreign officials and scholars who had done programs with the U.S. Institute of Peace or received U.S. grants.
The best and brightest. And they had this image and admiration of the United States.
An admiration, Mitchell said, that led them to side with America despite all of its flaws. Now he fears not only will the U.S. understand less about the world, but other countries will be less understanding of the U.S. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. The average American spends up to 5 hours a day on their smartphone. All that screen time can affect your mood. How to be less tied to your phone, next time on Here and Now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. When the ice melted off a lake in Minnesota a few weeks ago, the town of Cologne got invaded by bald eagles. Dozens of eagles popped up out of nowhere. Now photographers are swarming too. A conservationist thinks the eagles are after all the fish that are in the lake this year. So many that 10,000 had to be removed to keep the water clear. The town wants to keep the lake stocked and bring the eagles back next year. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldad.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. College basketball fans are looking forward to the men's Final Four this weekend. While the top seeds in this year's tournament get ready for their semifinal games, most other basketball programs are starting to think about next season. For the Indiana Hoosiers, it means literally starting from scratch after their head coach resigned and all of their players graduated or are planning to transfer. Join us now to discuss how Indiana is rebuilding their team with a new coach and no players is Zach Osterman, who reports on IU Athletics for the Indianapolis Star. Well, this is the definition, Zach, of a clean slate. So how is the new head coach, Darren DeVries, approaching this challenge?
Yeah, I think this sort of roster turnover has become more manageable in recent years with the escalating phenomenon of player movement and the lessening of transfer rules. And so you were seeing more often, you know, rosters turning over in significant numbers, sometimes even when there isn't a coaching change. I think DeVries, like any coach, certainly wants to get to a place where annually there is more balance, where you're not dependent upon transfers. I think that's certainly what DeVries is going to be focused on, is putting his roster back together primarily through transfers.
Yeah, so he can reload pretty quickly. Even though he's losing players, he can reload them through this transfer portal. So tell us about the transfer portal, what it does, and why it makes it easier for players to move around.
So the transfer portal started a few years ago. It's a mechanism to be able to just track transfers a little bit more closely, streamline the process somewhat as the practice of transferring, you know, started to really sort of tick up across all sports. I think what's happened is, especially when it's been sort of coupled to the idea of athlete compensation through name, image, and likeness rules, the portal has really, I think, come to be sort of inextricably linked to the idea of athlete agency. It has also become, I think, shorthand just for the era that college athletics is in right now of athletes in all sports being more comfortable transferring from one school to another. And in many cases, I think, looking or at least wanting to examine their market value to see if there's not more money for them to earn somewhere else.
I was thinking in the Indiana situation, the one thing DeVries can offer a player that maybe other coaches can't is playing time. I mean, he has no players, right? So someone has to actually dribble the basketball. At least five people have to do it, and maybe someone or a couple others on the bench. So what kind of a player do you think he'll be looking for?
I mean, initially, he's probably going to have to lean more heavily on transfers, especially in, as you talk about there, the positions that are going to command the greatest roles. DeVries has said that his long-term preference is to get to a place where, you know, his roster is a healthier balance of players who have been recruited out of high school, developed for 2 or 3 years, and then put into larger roles. But short-term, I think you are probably, if you're Indiana, looking at a roster that's going to be mostly all new faces.
It sounds like Indiana's situation, although seemingly on the surface unique, is not maybe going to be as uncommon in the future.
This has just become more commonplace, and fans see enough portal successes every year to believe that they shouldn't have that many down years anymore, especially at a place like Indiana that's going to have the name, image, and likeness resources and potentially the revenue-sharing dollars to be very competitive in acquiring and keeping talent.
That's Zach Osterman with the Indianapolis Star. Zach, thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Communities thrived for years on the peninsula and islands in the lagoon around Nigeria's crowded commercial capital, Lagos. But things have changed over the last decade. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports.
57-year-old Samuel Adozie makes his living on Takwa Bay, one of the most popular beaches in Lagos. He strolls across the white sand each weekend, as he has for decades, a guitar hanging across his lean frame, earning tips as he serenades visitors with covers of classic songs. While he plays, people lounge in wooden cabanas facing the shore, or play badminton and soccer on the sand. Others sit on the nearby rocks to fish or watch the waves. But there's a darker side to life here for the lower-income communities who populate the area around the bay. They sustain the beach and depend on it, but increasingly face violence and uncertainty. Among them is 40-year-old Esther Isobo. She runs a bar selling palm wine, a milky alcoholic drink tapped from palm trees.
I was here in 1984. I was a little baby anyway.
She's lived on Takwa Bay her whole life, in a wooden bungalow her uncle built, until it was destroyed 5 years ago.
One day we just wake up, they say, 1 hour, everybody back.
Speaking in Pidgin, she describes how scores of armed Navy personnel arrived at dawn. Without any warning, they ordered her and about 5,000 other people who lived by the sea to leave.
They destroyed the house. They don't already scatter everything. Everything. They don't push everything down. Everything don't destroy.
She said they destroyed everything. She didn't even have time to gather her belongings before bulldozers razed her home. Since then, Isobo and hundreds who run businesses catering to tourists have been allowed to return, but they aren't allowed to build any permanent structures. So now she lives in a small shack that leaks when it rains.
Yeah, this is where I'm sleeping. This is a life. It's not fair. I don't know why they are treating us like this.
The evictions at Takwa Bay aren't isolated. Tens of thousands in beach communities on a 60-mile stretch of peninsula and islands around the Atlantic coast have been forcibly displaced by the Nigerian Navy, backed by the government. The latest eviction was last year in Okogoro, a 100-year-old community of a few thousand people. But now it's mostly deserted, covered in heaps of rubble.
This is where you stay?
This is where I stay.
58-year-old Felicia Ekrakene speaks in Pidgin and is squatting in a demolished house near the shore.
At once, just one day, I said, make we carry our load. No feeling, no pity.
She said without warning, the 2,000 or so people living here were forced out last year. Now Ekrakene and a few others who've stayed live like fugitives, fleeing into the bushes whenever naval officers arrive.
The property we get, not the U government give us. We suffer for it.
She said she strived for years to build her home here, but now it's gone. The Nigerian Navy claimed they've evicted residents for stealing oil from pipelines that flow through the lagoon, costing millions of dollars a year for Africa's biggest oil producer. But community advocates say there's a more sinister motive at play.
It's a clear case of a legitimate law enforcement purpose that was extended and abused to carry out a large-scale land grab of prime real estate waterfront properties.
Megan Chapman is a lawyer and founder of Justice Empowerment Initiative, an NGO providing legal support for displaced communities.
Essentially, what you've seen is a privatization of the beach in the hands of a few powerful interests.
And on a boat ride around the coastline, this is plain to see. Several luxury beach clubs have sprung up across the lagoon and near the Atlantic coast. And communities that were cleared out years ago have been replaced by resorts and bungalows, bars and pools leased for parties and weekend getaways. Back on Takwa Bay, Esther Isobo still sells her palm wine. This was not how your life was before.
No, I was living okay.
She says everything has changed now. The Navy has established their own businesses and have doubled the entry fee to the beach for their own profit. Less people come here now, making it harder to make a living. And she feels they could be forced out at any moment.
I'm dying silently. Insidely, I'm dying silently. I will not tell you a lie.
And she says she's putting on a brave face to cover how she really feels. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
Got a plant that's seen better days? I do. NPR producer Ana Perez has several and went to find out, are any of them salvageable?
With spring in full bloom, the patio is where I want to be. But I'm not looking into a bright green oasis.
Super dead.
It's more like various shades of brown, with the exception of one plant that's hanging on for dear life, my strawberry plant.
It's got some growth on it.
Is it past the point of no return?
It is something that comes up frequently.
John Valentino is president of John and Bob's Corporation out in Fresno, California. He specializes in all things plants. I showed him my sad strawberry plant.
Did you have that outside?
I did.
While talking over Zoom, Valentino checked for a few indicators.
If there's no leaves on the plant, then there's a big problem because that's plants' way of surviving and thriving. Then check to see if there's any green in the branches at all or any buds that you can see that have life in them.
And my plant had life, that little sprig of green. Valentino says I shouldn't feel discouraged over my bad luck with plants. According to a 2024 survey from Tree Triage, a landscape service, 1 in 6 people kill every plant they grow. But after learning mine was savable, I decided to take a trip to my local plant shop.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Caitlin Tuttle is co-owner and creative director of Planter in Washington, D.C.
Let's figure it out.
Tuttle's team DMs treatment plans to customers on Instagram who are struggling with their plants.
We just run through a series of questions. When was it last repotted? Where does it live? Have you been keeping it outside over the winter? So we try and ask all the questions to really get to the bottom of it so people feel armed with information.
All plants can be easy, Tuttle stresses, as long as planters have the right information.
So it's understand your light, what direction do your windows face, watering, making sure people know you're fully saturating your soil, and then of course nutrition.
Now for the diagnosis for my ailing strawberry plant.
Is my plant
thriving?
Good.
It just needed a little TLC. And while repotting,
spill around, pack it down,
and pruning it, planter co-owner James Beach found a little surprise.
The radio folks can't see, but there's an actual little baby strawberry in here. So yeah, just to keep it up.
Just in time for spring. Anna Bettis, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin.